From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Palestinian militants killed as Israel strikes Gaza. Iraq's parliament deadlocked, postpones next session for a month. Kidnapped women escape in Nigeria. Those stories and more are coming up. Good morning, I'm Ray Kugel. Militants in the Gaza Strip fired dozens of rockets at Israel Monday, setting off air raid sirens as the military rushed more forces to the border. The Israeli military says 40 rockets were launched in an hour as night fell. Israel retaliated with airstrikes. The militant group Hamas says at least six of its members were killed. Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli warplanes struck 14 targets in Gaza, including one that hit a tunnel, causing high casualties among fighters from the ruling Palestinian militant group Hamas. Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev said it was retaliation for dozens of Palestinian rocket attacks.
We are acting to protect our people. We are targeting the terrorists in Gaza, those firing the rockets, and Hamas has to understand this must stop.
Hamas vowed that Israel will pay a tremendous price. Hamas spokesman Mushir al-Masri said Israel started this escalation of violence and it is up to Israel to end it. Until then, he said, Hamas will defend the Palestinian people. Israel stepped up airstrikes on Hamas 10 days ago after blaming the group for the kidnap and murder of three Israeli teenagers. Hamas responded with rocket and mortar attacks. Tension has also been running high in Jerusalem after a revenge killing for the murder of the three seminary students. Israeli police have arrested six Jewish suspects in connection with the kidnap and murder of a 16-year-old Palestinian that set off riots in Jerusalem. Israeli President Shimon Peres.
We shall not cover anything. We shall discover all the people that act criminally, killed, kidnapped, tortured, and on that we shall not make any compromise. We are seriously and realistically trying to remain a democratic and human country.
Police say three of the Israeli suspects have confessed to the murder and reconstructed the crime at a Jerusalem forest where the Palestinian teenager's charred body was dumped. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the victim's father and said the attackers will be punished with the full force of the law. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
An American naval crew is beginning to destroy Syrian chemical weapons on board a U.S. container ship in the Mediterranean. The U.S. Defense Department says it'll be taking about 2 months to destroy the 600 metric tons of chemical agents. They include mustard gas and the raw materials for sarin nerve gas. This processed material will later be transferred to Finland and Germany for final disposal. Syria agreed to hand over its chemical weapons in response to a UN agreement brokered last year. Iraq's deadlocked parliament postponed its next session until mid-August, unable to decide how to split political power. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki told Western leaders last month the new government would be formed early in July. But on Monday, Parliament put off its next session until August 12th in hopes of resolving who should fill the country's top three positions. Mr. Maliki's Shiite political bloc won the most seats in the April elections, but not a majority. Many Iraqi lawmakers are accusing him of failing to give enough political consideration to the country's minority Sunni population. He himself has balked at demands to not seek a third term as prime minister. With the escalating crisis in Iraq, concerns are growing in Turkey over the economic fallout. Iraq is Turkey's second largest trading partner. Turkish companies export about $14 billion a year. Dorian Jones has details from Istanbul.
With the radical Islamist group ISIL scoring major military gains in Iraq, concerns are growing about the economic impact for Turkey. Sinan Ülgen is a visiting scholar for the Carnegie Institute in Brussels.
Turkey's exports to the countries in the region have been affected on two grounds. One, because of instability, of course, but the other one is because of the land routes to other markets in the Middle East have been blocked by the instability both in Syria and in Iraq.
But analysts say the impact on Turkish exports to Iraq could have been worse because around 75% of those exports are to the relatively stable Iraqi Kurdish region, which has largely escaped the impact of ISIL. Turkish transit trade to the lucrative Gulf markets is another story, says political consultant Attila Yeşilada of Global Source Partners. He says the Iraq crisis coincides with rising diplomatic tensions between Cairo and Ankara.
The Egyptian authorities have started causing trouble to our trucks and ferries. 30,000 lorries, trucks, traveling to Iraq before the crisis, and now that number has dropped to, say, 5,000 or so.
Turkish economic woes could yet worsen, with ISIL continuing to threaten regional stability. One area of concern, analyst Yeşilada warns, is rising oil prices that will bring new costs, if not in the near future, in the medium term, for energy importer Turkey.
Could expand over time. The most obvious example is the price of oil. Every $10 jump in Brent oil adds $4 billion to our energy deficit and 50 basis points to the CPI inflation.
Analyst Ülgen says that situation is likely to depend on whether the threat of ISIL can be contained. He says if the situation deteriorates, so will the economic pain for Turkey.
The most important will be whether if the situation continues to worsen, then Turkey's risk perception can be affected, which would raise the cost of capital for Turkey and Turkish companies. That, I think, will be even more crucial for the Turkish economy.
Observers point out stellar growth underpinned the first decade of the AK Party's rule. But growth in the past few years has markedly slowed, with Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan running for presidency in August elections and a general election in June 2015. Observers say keeping the economy running could prove to be Mr. Erdogan's greatest test. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
Preliminary results from last month's Afghan presidential runoff vote show former finance minister Ashraf Ghani well ahead of his rival Abdullah Abdullah, who topped the first round of balloting. The results were supposed to be announced last week, but recounts at about 2,000 polling stations where fraud was alleged forced the Afghan Independent Election Commission to delay them until Monday. Ayaz Ghul has details.
Even on Monday, journalists had to wait for several hours before Commission Chief Ahmed Yusuf Nuristani arrived to declare the results. He said that more than 8 million Afghans voted in the runoff election and that over 56% of the tally went to Ashraf Ghani, while his rival Abdullah Abdullah received approximately 44%. However, the Chief Election Commissioner cautioned against drawing any conclusions at this stage. Nuristani says the announcement of preliminary results does not mean that the leading candidate is the winner, adding that probe into rigging complaints might change the outcome. He acknowledged that vote fraud took place, saying that even some governors and government officials were involved in it. Nuristani promised to conduct a wider probe before announcing final results, which are due later this month. Abdullah refuses to accept any results until the Election Commission invalidates all dirty votes and has claimed to have received majority of the clean votes. His representatives have been talking with Ghani's team to agree on a comprehensive audit of polling stations where rigging allegedly took place. But the negotiations have apparently failed to defuse political tensions stemming from allegations of what Abdullah says industrial-scale fraud. The director of the privately run Election Watch Organization of Afghanistan, Jandad Spingar, says that unless the two candidates find a peaceful political solution to the disagreement, Afghanistan may witness violent protests in the coming days.
Political negotiation goes well among both candidates or they reach agreement on some sheer power in the future, it might be the only solution to stop that conflict. Otherwise, potential for conflict is much high in the current situation.
The winner of the election will replace President Hamid Karzai, but the political controversy has dashed hopes for a smooth transfer of power from one elected government to another, the first in the history of Afghanistan. Abdullah alleges that Karzai's administration has played a role in rigging the vote in favor of Ghani, charges the president's office rejects. Ghani, a former World Bank official, also dismissed allegations his lead in the race is the result of fraud vote. He says he wants the democratic process to be completed sooner rather than later to end political and economic uncertainty gripping Afghanistan. An early resolution to the dispute is considered vital at a time when most foreign troops are preparing to withdraw from Afghanistan by the end of the year, while Taliban insurgents have stepped up attacks around the country. A bilateral security agreement between Kabul and Washington is awaiting the signature of the new Afghan president that would allow around 10,000 American soldiers to stay in the country until the end of 2016. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Pro-Russian separatists retreating ahead of a Ukrainian military offensive in eastern Ukraine dug in Monday in the city of Donetsk, building barricades and erecting checkpoints along the main roads. As Ukrainian forces pushed south from Slovyansk toward Donetsk, three bridges linking the two cities were destroyed in explosions. It's not clear whether rebels triggered the blast to slow the Ukrainian offensive or if government troops targeted those structures in a push to keep supplies and arms from reaching rebels in the city. Former Georgian president and Soviet foreign minister Eduard Shevardnadze has died at the age of 86 following a long illness. Mr. Shevardnadze played a vital role in ending the Cold War, helped negotiate the unification of Germany, and was a diplomatic face of Soviet reforms during his time as foreign minister. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, he returned to Georgia and helped stabilize the country in its early days. Mr. Shevardnadze was elected president in 1995.
I'm Ira Melman with an invitation for you to come and visit the American Cafe. It's a place where you can come and get a taste of America, from the bitter to the sweet. This past week, the United States recognized some mistakes it had made in the past.
Some of these soldiers fought and died for a country that did not always see them as equal.
For some in the Asian American communities, some stereotypes, although positive, are not always helpful.
What ends up happening is that we don't see what problems actually exist under the surface.
And then there are those who put it all on the line at a very popular festival in the capital city of Texas.
I don't know what to do with my life, but I really, 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 really want to be famous.
Come and visit the American Cafe. We have a new program for you every week. You can hear it on the radio, on the web, or iTunes, or at voanews.com. Come join us. No reservation necessary.
In Nigeria, authorities say more than 60 women and girls kidnapped in the middle of last month escaped over the weekend from their presumed Boko Haram captors. But hundreds of other girls kidnapped in April are still missing. Heather Murdoch has more from Abuja.
The escape of the kidnapped women is one bright spot, but hundreds of other girls kidnapped in April remain missing. And it appears the five-year-old Boko Haram insurgency is getting deadlier and more far-reaching. Following the arrest of three women last week, Nigerian security forces said they are tracking a female wing of Boko Haram. This is lawyer Tony Meza.
Right now in Nigeria, the security situation is worsening, and we are beginning to see both the militants are both women, they co-opt women in, they employ children, youths, so we don't know which who. So,
usually confined to the northeast, the insurgency is also spreading geographically, he says. Since April, three bombs have killed more than 100 people in the Nigerian capital. Two of the attacks were in a bus station and the third at a mall in a wealthy central neighborhood. Boko Haram militants claimed responsibility for the first bus station bombing in late April, as well as abducting more than 200 schoolgirls who remain missing. General Supervisor Dandesan Nwankwa of the Izu Chikwu Bus Company in the oil-rich Niger Delta says if militants can strike in the heart of Nigeria's capital, Abuja, he says he fears they may seek to attack the Niger Delta, the heart of the country's economy.
We have always put in place measures in our own internal security system to avert all this ugly incidents happening in other places.
He says his company requires every bus passenger to be searched before boarding, and homeless people are no longer allowed to sleep in the bus station.
And that searching, all the passengers will not be allowed to enter that vehicle until the vehicle decides to move, so that somebody will not infiltrate something inside the bus.
Boko Haram has killed thousands of people in 5 years of attacks. The group says it wants to impose its own harsh version of Islamic law, but most of the victims have been Muslims. Lawyer Meza says churches have also been frequent targets, and many churches recently imposed bans on handbags as part of non-government efforts to fight the insurgency.
These measures that women should not carry bags to churches, people should not sleep, be allowed to sleep motorbikes, people should not be allowed to sleep on completed buildings. They are all proactive measures to ensure that we don't allow these hoodlums to mill around us.
Nigeria is Africa's largest exporter, an industry that earns most of the country's national budget. Boko Haram has never attacked oil-producing regions in the south, but it has threatened to. Boko Haram frequently carries out the terror it promises, but it has also made unrealistic threats, including against foreign heads of state, both living and dead. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel traveled to Beijing this week for meetings with their Chinese counterparts on trade and security issues. As VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports, those talks are expected to include discussions on new Chinese oil rigs in disputed waters off Vietnam that are driving up tensions in the South China Sea.
Vietnam says the oil rigs are within its territorial waters and released this video of what it says is a Chinese vessel ramming a Vietnamese fishery control boat near the site. Vietnam is working with the Philippines on legal challenges to Chinese claims in the South China Sea, where Malaysia, Brunei, and Taiwan also have competing claims. Vietnam is especially vulnerable, says American University professor Hilary Mann Leverett.
Both Japan and the Philippines have a defense treaty with the United States, where the United States is obligated to come to their defense even over a craggy island. We don't have that with Vietnam. So China can push Vietnam even further than it pushes Japan or the Philippines.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman King Gong says those pushing for international arbitration in the South China Sea are violating legal norms.
Some countries are waving the signboard of law to encroach upon the legitimate rights and interests of other countries, putting on a legitimate cloak to cover up their law-violating behaviors.
While the United States is helping upgrade the Filipino Navy, Washington is not taking a position on any of the rival claims in the South China Sea. American Enterprise Institute analyst Michael Oslin.
But that doesn't mean that our policy should be frozen or paralyzed when we see, for example, China acting coercively or acting aggressively. There's lots of things we can do, but the Obama administration, at least in this term, has decided that it is going to use the fig leaf of legal ambiguity in order not to get involved.
Which he says undercuts the value of this week's Strategic and Economic Dialogue, or SNED.
Seriously, we have to ask, what is the point of the SNED anymore? It has achieved nothing substantive.
Foreign and defense ministers' talks in Beijing follow China's Navy joining for the first time U.S.-led naval exercises off Hawaii. U.S. officials say that could help address multilateral challenges. Chinese officials say it shows the positive attitudes of the Chinese armed forces in maintaining regional security and stability. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
The United States says it'll work with Germany to resolve concerns over whether one of its intelligence employees was a double agent spying for Washington, but is declining to say whether the allegation is true. Chancellor Angela Merkel, on a visit to Beijing, said the spy allegation is serious and, if true, would violate the trust between Germany and the United States. German authorities have described the suspect as a low-level employee of Berlin's Foreign Intelligence Agency. He was detained after allegedly being pinpointed as the author of an email offering to sell secret documents to Russia. A strong earthquake on the Pacific coast rocked southern Mexico and Central America Monday, killing at least five people, damaging homes, hospitals, and churches. The U.S. Geological Survey says a 6.9 magnitude quake was centered 8 kilometers northeast of Puerto Madero, Mexico, near the Guatemala border. The quake collapsed dozens of homes, triggered landslides, and caused power outages. Earthquakes are shaking the Midwestern U.S. state of Oklahoma more than any other state in the country, even California. Before 2009, Oklahoma had about two earthquakes of magnitude 3.0 or greater annually. This year, the number skyrocketed to more than 200. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel explains, a new study finds clues to that increase in underground wells drilled by the gas and oil industry.
Katie Kernan was at home in 2011 when the 5.6 magnitude earthquake struck. It was the biggest ever recorded in Oklahoma. Speaking by Skype, Kernan says the earthquake certainly caught her attention.
Shook my house pretty strongly. I was actually mildly scared. You could look up and see the top of the roof shaking.
Now a geophysics professor at Cornell University, Kernan led a study to examine the huge expanding swarm of quakes in Oklahoma.
And we decided that trying to answer why one earthquake happened was insufficient when you looked at the broader area and there were, you know, far more earthquakes. And so we wanted to figure out what the root cause was, you know, what was actually causing the entire part of central Oklahoma to light up.
She suspected that gas and oil wells had something to do with it. Oklahoma has some 4,400 underground disposal wells where wastewater is injected deep back in the earth after drilling. Her team calculated how easily the fluid moved through the rocks and charted the rise in water pressure at 89 well sites.
Once we had the earthquake locations and the fluid pressure increases in space and time, we were able to correlate those two together and figure out how much fluid pressure went up at each earthquake location from those wells. And what we were able to find was that the fluid pressure at the earthquakes went up enough to trigger the earthquakes in basically each case.
Kernan hopes the study results reported in the journal Science can help the oil and gas industry as it considers how to better manage and treat wastewater to mitigate any impact.
So I think industry can learn, you know, basically what are the largest risks, what are the risk factors for wells for triggering earthquakes, and then design the wells to keep those subsurface pressures lower to lower that risk of potentially triggering a quake.
The study also highlights the value of monitoring water pressure and seismic activity at injection wells, especially those near major faults. The oil and gas industry takes the issue very seriously, and we'll look at Kernan's findings, says Sean Bennett, a spokesman for the Independent Petroleum Association of America, which represents oil and natural gas producers. He says the industry is actively engaged in studying the problem.
Currently, there are regulators from several states, including Ohio, where I'm from, who have formed the state-induced seismicity work group in order to address this extremely rare occurrence. The oil and gas industry always looks forward to working with them to ensure that the safe production of our oil and gas resources are done in a proper manner.
Bennett says mechanisms are in place to mitigate earthquake risk at disposal well sites. He says it's a matter of finding out which approaches work best and then implementing them in a responsible manner. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Former players of the U.S. National Football League suffering from years of hard hits to the head received some good news Monday when a federal judge ruled in their favor on compensation claims. Lawyers for more than 4,500 former players had sued the league. A top NFL official called the decision comprehensive and said the league will work with the plaintiffs to implement the terms. Retired players who have or develop profound neurological problems could receive $1 million or more. That's it for this edition of International Edition. Thank you for joining us. Be sure to follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is Today in History. On July 7, 1520, Spanish conquistadors defeated an Aztec army at the Battle of Otumba. The Spanish were greatly outnumbered by the huge Aztec force, but gained the victory because of their mounted troops. The Aztecs, who had no experience with horses, were greatly confused when they were charged by Spanish troops on horseback. In 1863, the U.S. began its first military draft, seeking soldiers to serve in the Union Army during the Civil War. The conscriptions were controversial, and riots broke out in New York City. The riots were the largest civil insurrection up to that time, aside from the Civil War itself. In 1865, four people were hanged in Washington, D.C. after being convicted of conspiring with John Wilkes Booth to assassinate President Abraham Lincoln. In 1898, U.S. President William McKinley signed the Newlands Resolution, annexing Hawaii as a territory of the United States. On this day in 1937, Japanese troops occupying much of northeastern China fought with Chinese forces near the capital Peking in what has become known in the West as the Marco Polo Bridge Incident. This local skirmish is seen as the beginning of the Second Sino-Japanese War. In 1946, Mother Francesca S. Cabrini became the first American to be canonized by the Roman Catholic Church. She had founded an institute that supported Italian immigrants to the United States. In 1954, Elvis Presley made his radio debut on Memphis radio station WHBQ. The station played his first recording for Sun Records, That's All Right. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Barack Obama met with Chilean President Michelle Bachelet on June 30th to underscore their country's long-standing partnership rooted in a strong commitment to democratic traditions. The fact that Chile, across the political spectrum, respects and fights for the democratic process, said President Obama, makes it a great model for the entire hemisphere. The United States and Chile are committed to economic integration and open markets. In 2004, the two countries implemented a bilateral free trade agreement, which has increased exports and economic opportunities in both countries. Since the FTA entered into force, bilateral trade has grown to $28 billion. U.S. goods exported to Chile increased by 545%, and goods imported from Chile increased by 180% since 2003. Recognizing the need to broadly spread the benefits of trade, both governments signed an agreement to create a network of small business development centers in Chile as part of the hemisphere-wide Small Business Network of the Americas. The U.S. and Chile also cooperate on energy. In June, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation approved a loan guarantee of up to $230 million to support the construction of a 141-megawatt solar plant in Chile. Up to another $1.4 million in funding will strengthen Chile's power sector and regional integration. The United States has progressed with its 100,000 Strong in the Americas initiative to increase academic exchanges between the U.S. and Latin America, including Chile. In addition to the Fulbright program, five 100,000 Strong innovation grants, totaling over $211,000, have been awarded so far this year to support partnerships between U.S. and Chilean universities. On development and security, the United States and Chile signed a declaration of intent to launch a Caribbean-wide trilateral partnership campaign. It will leverage the combined assets and expertise of the U.S. and Chile to promote growth, good governance, and security in the Caribbean. The United States and Chile also signed a joint statement that increases cooperation among law enforcement agencies in order to target, disrupt, and deter human traffickers. The statement will enhance bilateral exchanges of information on known organized criminal groups engaged in human trafficking. The United States remains committed to working with Chile to strengthen democracy, spread the benefits of open economic engagement, and advance security and development in the hemisphere.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.